Malcolm Honlein is in Israel. He is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update. Nice to speak to you, Mr. Honlein. How is the Holy Land?
Sweet, savory, and nutty.
That would be.
I think that recipe sort of describes everything here.
Yeah, an apt
but the weather's gorgeous, and we had a lot of rain earlier in the week, and a lot of good news. Israel was determined to be the second most educated country in the world, second only to Canada.
Wow.
And there's a OECD report, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and they said that they compare the education systems with other countries, and they include how many adults have education, what level, how many pupils drop out, et cetera. And they said that the percentage of Israeli adults with university or college diplomas is 45%, which is quite remarkable. But they do point to some, you know, troubling signs for the future and things that Israel has to do. But
troubling signs education-wise, you mean?
Yeah, but and also the drop in spending relative to GDP. But Israel is the only country that came out of the recession and during the recession with a lower debt per income and per GDP, and with the most consistent growth of any Western country. So people who say we don't give good news, they're sweet, savory, and nutty.
Yeah, well, we've proven them wrong, that's for sure.
And Israel was admitted to the UN Development Program, which is a recognition that Israel is not a developing country, but a developed country, and has much to offer to others. So there we have, we've met our quota for good news, and
I can't wait to share.
I hope everybody appreciates it.
The next time you're here in this building, I'll share with the audience what our argument was about good and bad news before this conversation off the air. We'll see if that qualifies as good news or not. Anyway, so JewishWorld.com has a unique ability because of the positioning every week to influence what I start with. And what do you make of this Adelson phobia and the big exposés? I mean, that's probably the wrong word. Maybe analysis or news analysis would be better when it comes to him, how so much of the media is fascinated with him and his influence in this election. Does it bother you that such a high-profile pro-Israel Jew is taking such a role in such an important process right now?
Well, I think everybody has a right to do with the money they've earned, honestly, and to distribute it as they wish. Sometimes I wonder whether this is the best investment of money given all the other needs in our community, but Mr. Adelson gives generously to things like Birthright and Yad Vashem and to the Jewish Day School in Las Vegas. I think that, the visibility of it, I don't think was his choice. I think it was the exposure of it, and the fact that he gave it in such a large sum at one time, certainly in the midst of a highly contested and hotly contested race, gives it a very high profile. So I think it's a subject that can be debated and discussed.
I hope
that people will also focus on the congressional races, which, as I've said many times here, is equally important and one where you can have sometimes more of an impact, and to not focus just on the presidential races, but look at local races, especially given redistricting, which could change things, and the huge number of people who are stepping down. Dan Burton this week, others, just every week, new people are announcing that they're not running again. And that's something we have to pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah, you didn't really answer about your level of comfort or discomfort having such a high-profile pro-Israel Jew involved in this process, but I guess that's difficult to quantify anyway, right?
Right.
Okay, I figured as much. One of the things that made me very uncomfortable, I don't even know if you saw this, because I don't know what kind of attention it got. I may have just stumbled upon this story, and it really didn't get the attention I thought it would. Down in Florida, and you know that the Jewish communities of Florida were big targets in the Republican campaigns down there. And it looked like there was as much chicanery or as much suspicious behavior that goes on when it comes to campaigns and negative publicity and bashing of the other opponent. It looked like they were crossing some lines this week. I'm referring specifically to a story about Romney and being being, I believe, on the board or one of the owners of a nursing home facility that ended up being turned not kosher. And the other campaign went ahead and said, look at his attitude toward Jewish people who want to keep kosher. I don't know if you're familiar with this story, are you?
I thought it was about some legislation or something that in the end denied or...
Oh, correct. I'm sorry. It was a legislation, correct. It wasn't an ownership.
And it wasn't right. Denying. It wasn't targeted at them. And it's an attempt, obviously, as everything else is now, and especially because you have these super PACs, which are not tied to the candidates who can distance themselves from the charges, but it was repeated, and then calls were made to
right.
people's homes telling them the story that which grew to the fact that he was denying food to Holocaust survivors.
Right, that's right. Correct.
As I recall, that was the right. story, and I wasn't in the U.S. this week, so I got over this.
No, that's it. You know it. You know it better than I do. That's exactly what happened.
I think it's outrageous that what's happening to the campaigns and how, you know, we're not focused on issues anymore. And for Republicans, I think have to look at this and say they're destroying their own candidates. They've done the work for the Democrats, the question, others will say, well, getting all of this stuff out now is good because they can't use it later, but it does remain, and I think it does create scars in people's memories.
Sure.
You know, they don't just forget the thing. They remember something negative about was said about the guy. They don't even remember the details, as you pointed out.
Right. As I demonstrated.
No, seriously, because
right.
it's so much. It's
right.
overload,
sure.
and we're going through this. Whoever made the decision that it should be 25 debates should be hung, and the fact that we have such a long campaign, I mean, we still have 9 months or 8 months of this to go, and we haven't come to the conventions. It's just, I just understand why people get frustrated and get tired of it and walk away from it, but we can't afford to. This is a very important election. Very important decisions are made. People should know about the candidates, should know what they have to say. I don't know if in 3 months anybody's even going to care because they'll be so tired of it.
That's true, and we're 7 months away from those conventions.
What everybody has to do, all your listeners, now, make sure you're registered so you can vote, get involved in the campaigns, find out who your local candidates are. They are important. You have important city council races and other races. You have people running for Congress, even in New York, who are questionable, have questionable positions and views on important issues. Get to know who they are and get involved. That's an important message.
Obviously, we're very curious about what you've seen in Israel. It is unbelievable in 1 week, as much as this whole issue of the possibility of Israel striking Iran has become, as big as it's become all the way until last Friday when we last spoke, it is unbelievable how much more so it has become an issue in the media, between the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, between the 60 Minutes interview last Sunday night, and then it seems everywhere, and the congressional hearings this week, it seems everywhere you turn, this is the Anderson Cooper last night. It seems that everywhere you turn, this is now, excuse the term, an exploding issue. It just doesn't, not only doesn't it go away, it just continues to grow and grow. If you read that New York Times Magazine article, we'll take that as an example from last Sunday, nobody knows anything. Outside of the political leaders in Israel, who obviously are going to have to make some type of decision down the road, and the intelligence leaders in Israel, who I pray, you know, have accurate information about what's really going on, there's no observer, including the geniuses in the media, who could possibly evaluate what Israel should or shouldn't do with Iran.
And the situation can change daily. It's part of the reason, I think, is that, number one, it is a hot issue and an important issue, but I think they're trying to get off of the election, look for something else, and this, of course, becomes an important issue. And this week, because of the conference that was held here, one at which I spoke, the focus of many of the main speakers was on Iran, and therefore, you know, got a lot of press, and a lot of foreign press covers them. And in fact, I mean, there were a lot of important developments this week, every day, actually, which people don't even factor. And unfortunately, I heard some of the speakers, experts on this, who really were saying things that don't take into account the full panoply of developments. You had the director of the National Intelligence Agency speaking this week in Washington, and he talked about Iran preparing terror to respond to any or to preempt any attack.
Mm-hmm.
They are training people in the Iran, but more importantly, and in the region, but also here in the United States. Iran this week announced that they doubled their defense budget at a time when their economy is in collapse. Their currency continues to fall. I think last week when we talked about it, it was at $16,000 to a dollar. Now it's $18,000, even though officially they say $11,500. But this is more than cut in half from a year ago. And it falls some days 5%. But the government, interestingly, makes money on this because they sell the oil and gas, the oil, for euros and dollars. But they pay their bills in reals, which are today worth less than half of what they cost. So they're paying off the debts cheap and taking in the money. They launched a Spanish-language TV. They are taking more assertive actions in many places. We're seeing their involvement with Iran being escalated very seriously. Panetta this week spoke, the defense secretary, about a 1 year till they have the bomb.
Right.
And the United States spoke about buying the 30,000-pound Buster bunkers bombs because they say that's what they will need for any action in Iran. And my point is that it's exactly what you said, that there's so much happening. The head of the Mossad, it was revealed, was in Washington this week holding discussions. The defense minister was there recently. And we know that there's much more going on. That Iran, it was reported by Israeli intelligence sources, were targeting Israeli targets abroad, and they thwarted an attack in Baku, in Azerbaijan, in Thailand, in Turkey, and that many more are probably in the works. And this is a reflection of the complexity and what a decision entails, that when people treat this subject lightly and just speculate, you know, Israel will pull the trigger, Israel won't pull the trigger, it requires so much of a decision that people, I don't think, appreciate how important it is.
All right, let me ask you two things. The first is, and maybe this week, because you're there and you're having the meetings that you're having, you could give us a little bit more of a definitive outlook on this. It seems from all these analysts that there is a real split between the political and intelligence leaders in Israel, that the political leaders are more inclined to call for some type of strike against Iran, while the intelligence community in Israel is dead set against it. This is the picture that most of these analysts have painted over the last few days. Do you agree with that assessment?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't come down that clearly. What I think the political echelon is trying to do is to say, you got to put this issue on the agenda. You got to have the military threat has to be credible. Not just that we say, you know, all options are on the table, but it has to be a credible threat to the Iranians that military options are on the table. I think that the intelligence people are saying, look, this is very complicated. There's a lot of things that we have to take into account. Perhaps maybe because later on they don't want to be blamed if something goes wrong, or because this is their honest assessment of things, and sometimes it's former people who are in positions of importance formerly and not today. Though they are still credible, I guess.
But there were a lot of today's also quoted.
Yeah, the military people who are trying to say, look, this is not an easy decision. This is not Osirak, and it's a point we've made for years on the program. And, you know, when I go out to speak, I'm always asked this. Why if they could do Osirak? Because this is far more complicated. It's further. It's a much more powerful country. It's got a lot of the resources, and plants are spread out.
I understand.
More, as you know, Qum is underground.
Right. Yeah, we understand. We've spoken about this. But my question is, if the intelligence community and the current one in Israel strongly recommends against this, can a political leader make a decision to strike? I mean, doesn't it take it off the table if the intelligence community cannot come to a consensus that there's even a possibility that this would work or that it's a good idea?
They will definitely not take those things off the table. Besides, there are three. There's intelligence, there's the military, and there's the political echelon. They have to be in concert when the decision is made. And that decision, nobody disagrees with what each one is saying. The question is, at what point, they have to make a judgment, at what point is it either the option expires for Israel to act or someone to act? At what point is there a turning point where Iran does something that requires an immediate decision of action? So I'm not sure that the differences are quite as great as the rhetoric would indicate. You know, people are looking at the, you see the debate, for instance, over sanctions. Do sanctions work? Do they not work? You hear every possible view saying, well, they work, but they're not really working as well as you think. They could potentially work. No, there's no more potential for them to work. Are they impacting Iran? If you look at the bottom line, everybody says, yeah, it's impacting Iran. Is it sufficient? That's the question. Is it enough to really bring them down? You see, Iran this week changed the names on 90 of their 123 ships, you know, cargo ships, because of the sanctions. The economy is in ruins. They are having more limited access to banks. Their insurance rates are going up. We see that they're smuggling weapons on German and French ships, that they're investing so much in Syria and less and less in Hezbollah and Hamas because they don't have the resources, and with Hamas because they're angry at them. This is not, and none of this breaks down into a black and white issue.
Right. The America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard and listened to, sponsor WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is in Jerusalem speaking to us this morning. They made in the Times article, they made an interesting, they had an interesting overview of all the scientist assassinations that have taken place in Iran over the last couple of years. I would suspect, the way I read that article, what was surprising to me is that Iran never really retaliated for that. Now, I know that there have been attempts and there have been terrorist acts that have been thwarted by Israel, and we've gone into those details here. But it would seem to me that a country that is ready to retaliate and go crazy militarily, if possible, if Israel would strike them, it would seem the same country or the same administration would take much stronger action and have much stronger reaction if, in fact, they believe that Israel is responsible for taking out of these scientists. Is there any conclusion to reach based on that, or is their relative silence in the wake of these assassinations meaningless in terms of the big picture?
No, it's not meaningless. But I don't think it's a right reading. As I pointed out, the attacks in Baku, Thailand, and Turkey were retaliation. These were attacks that were all thwarted.
But not of the scope that they threaten to use and to implement.
Because they do not want to escalate and give Israel the excuse for coming in. Look, they threatened that if America tried to bring back our aircraft carrier through the straits, what did they threaten? To destroy it, to blow it up, that they would play havoc with
right,
us.
Right.
And what happened? The U.S., the Lincoln comes through the straits, nothing happens. And the United States was sitting back saying, make my day, do it. We're ready for you. And would have loved it if they gave them the chance. So they have to be careful about how they strike, too, because they know that the retribution could be far worse, and the escalation of violence, which they can't control, could be very serious. So, but they are doing things. You see their increased investment in Islamic Jihad as opposed to Hamas, by the way, which they see becoming more political, and the conversions of Islamic people to Shiism and a split with Hamas over the role in Syria or the role in Lebanon today. This week, one of the military people said Israel faces 20,000 missiles pointed at it at any one time in Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza, and perhaps much more. And who has the finger on the trigger is Iran.
But they still haven't unleashed it.
But they haven't unleashed it because in Lebanon, people don't want the backlash. Look at the demonstrations in Syria against Nasrallah. And the opposition forces this week said to Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, we will remember this. We will get you afterwards. And they are worried about it because they're worried about the backlash in Lebanon, which had been economically otherwise relatively stable. That's why you don't see them heating up the border. You don't see things happening as they keep threatening would happen. The same thing in Gaza. So you see the missiles, seven missiles flew last night, came across the border.
Right.
Islamic Jihad and these smaller groups are believed responsible for it. The situation in Gaza and Sinai deteriorating security-wise, and Egypt's obviously position compounding that.
Israel retaliated, right?
Israel, of course, retaliated, but that's not the retaliation that people are expecting. because Israel can't tolerate the situation, and people have to learn about what's really happening there to understand why the buildup of the rockets, the more right. sophisticated, they're getting rockets that they want to reach Tel Aviv, and with equipment that they're getting from Libya, from the stockpiles in Libya, have perhaps increased 20 or 30%, the influx of weapons into Gaza this year.
So let's put it this way then, because so many of us, of course, generalize and put everything in one big basket against Israel. There are many domestic problems, many domestic and local situations in places like Syria, Lebanon, etc., which also are impacted if somebody decides to take action against Israel. And we, of course, many of us, never consider those. You, with the big picture in mind, keep those in mind much more often.
Yes, absolutely. There are many ramifications, both on the part of Israel in making a decision about what happens to the other countries in the region if they attack, what happens on Israel's own borders. Can they attack Iran at the same time, be fighting Hamas, Hezbollah, maybe even Iran? Would Iran welcome it to divert attention from its internal problems and turn the attention against Israel? And part of the problem is that, people jump on every story as if it's the truth. I saw one organization condemn Jordan for allowing Mashal and the Hamas to move their headquarters there when the king, and I reported this last week, told us specifically he would not, and they did not. And people, though, take the story right away and run. And Turkey and Jordan were both approached by the Hamas guys, and they didn't do it. They didn't, for once, respond to it. So I think that we have to be careful in what we believe and what we don't believe in the terms of these stories.
Malcolm Honlein is in Jerusalem. So the United Nations...
And can I give one other example? There's a very important story about a Facebook picture of an IDF soldier pointing a weapon at a young Palestinian girl. This is exactly like the Mohammadur and others. It became so widespread. It turns out it's a complete concoction. It was taken at a Bahrain theatrical protest against Israel, because the soldier's holding an AK-47. Well, anybody knows Israelis use M-16s, AK-47 is used by the Arabs, and the uniform didn't fit in Israeli regulations, and yet this picture became so widespread and became evidence of how the IDF persecutes and prosecutes it, treats a teenager, young child, and it wasn't true.
Wow. Wow, unbelievable. The United Nations, is there an official... what do we call it? Resolution now against Syria or not?
There is not yet. There is a draft, which the Arabs and other members, but the problem is that Russia has said they will not allow anything. They try to water it down to such a point. In fact, not even calling for Assad's removal in this draft in order to get Russia on board, but it's not at all clear that, in fact, Russia will be on board. And we look at the developments in Syria. Look how many people are being killed, how many defections. You have hundreds of defectors in a single day, and they crush the revolts around Damascus, but we still see that there's more fighting going on. They are importing snipers from Hezbollah and Iran, and that this week, which is amazing, they got almost no coverage, five Iranians were captured in the fighting by the opposition Syrian forces. And these guys admitted that they were sent by the Iran Revolutionary Guard to Homs to participate in the quelling and in the killing, because many of the Syrian troops won't do it. And so they're resorting to bringing in these murderers. And the people now are turning much more, increasingly more, they have been for a long time, against Iran, Hezbollah, Russia. The demonstrations target them. And you never see anti-Israel demonstrations.
Hmm. Hillary Clinton's statements against Syria this week were sufficient or not?
It's not sufficient if we don't have a course of action that we're prepared. And I know that the options are limited when you can't use the UN, and we don't want to go in militarily, saying that this is not Libya, but it's turning into a Libya. And when you see in Libya the collapse of the order, with the militias fighting one another, and even in Iraq. So, the West has to learn to understand the region and to have a plan and to try to anticipate what will happen rather than pulling out. And I mean, the same thing is predicted if we pull out of Afghanistan, that the Taliban will take over. After all the hundreds of billions of dollars we invest in all these situations, it's, you know, and that's the problem with Syria. Who is planning today two things? One, to protect the minorities, and second, who's planning to control the weapons and the huge stockpiles of chemical weapons, missiles, and other things in Iran, in Syria, and not, as was reported this week, that there are plans to ship them to Hezbollah, even now for safekeeping, because Lebanon is considered and Hezbollah considered to be relatively capable of being able to protect it, as opposed to if Assad falls. Well, we want those things added to the arsenal of a terrorist organization. That's where we have to be clear, and we have to be able to send messages about what we will do to countries that violate the sanctions. There has to be real punishment of it. Like on Iran, we have to really go after the central bank. The Europeans are beginning to do it. In the United States, there's new legislation coming before the Congress to give more teeth to the resolutions that were passed and to continue to put the pressure on Iran. These sanctions help. Whether they can be determinant is the question.
Wow, unbelievable. Malcolm Honlein's in Israel. What did we learn this week from the results of the Likud primary? What did we learn about the position or strength or lack thereof of the prime minister, and any other observations you have about the Likud primary results?
Well, it was a foregone conclusion, I think, that Netanyahu would win. But the surprising part was the low turnout. It may have been even a little higher than the last time, but still not very high. He got, I think, 77% of the vote versus Fagelin. Fagelin is challenging some of the results, but the outcome is clear. Now the question is, when do they move to elections? And the elections are due in 2013. Many people feel that it might be earlier, even in 2012 or the beginning of 2013. I think it'll depend on political developments. I think it could depend on what happens in Iran, what happens in a lot of other situations that would determine when it's most propitious. You see the fighting in Kadima has gotten much worse. Sharon's son joins Livni. Right. The people then from Kadima complain that she has too many people with criminal records around her. Mofaz has picked up the support of a lot of people, key Kadima leaders. So and now Lapid announces he's going to have a party, then he's not. It's not clear what he will do. He came out with a very good statement on Jerusalem, that it belongs only to Jews.
Really?
Yes, surprising the people, and that was a big headline story here. I don't know if it got out elsewhere. So the political silly season is in the full force. The outcome of that should worry people, I think, in the States, that I'm afraid that by November we could also have an outcome that people just don't vote. If they don't like the choices, or they don't like the, you know, they're just tired of it or whatever, that's always very bad for democracy.
And with 08 viewed as one of the better turnouts in recent years.
Exactly. And by the way, there was one other thing here during this week, which is the flip side of it. You had the Canadian foreign minister here and the finance minister, who declared that Canada is the best friend of Israel. And if you would hear their speeches and their unabashed support, no qualifications, no, you know, hemming and hawing and telling the Palestinians straight off what the score is. And as one of them said, we don't have to go along to get along, meaning to get along with other countries. We don't have to go along with their anti-Israel postures and stuff. To hear that kind of courageous rhetoric and clear thinking was so refreshing and so exciting to people here. And Canada has President Prime Minister Harper has been amazing, and Baird, who told me himself, he said, look, I've been in Israel five times in a year and a half. He said, because I love to come here. I want to come here on vacation. I come here because I love it. And I'm staying on my own 2 extra days, 3 days to be here.
We had in our studio this week Lori Cardoza Moore, who you know is one of the leaders in the Christian community when it comes to support for Israel. She visited us here in New Jersey this week. And, of course, you know what I'm about to say. You know, I made the comment more than once in that conversation how I wish that members of our own community would speak about Israel the way that she does. In fact, it was funny. She said she grew up in South Florida, and the most of her class was Jewish. And I said I would bet at your high school reunion that you were probably the most right-wing politically when it came to Israel and settlement building and those types of issues. And she said, yeah, a lot of people at the reunion were pretty surprised about the things that I'm involved with right now. But that's the way life goes.
Well, I think we shouldn't underestimate our community. I think, and it is true, and we certainly welcome and appreciate the support of Christians. And I met, in fact, many people here from all over the world who are visiting, doing business, supporting, loving Israel. Sometimes we take Israel for granted. You know, when you're close, the families and people do take each other for granted. We take Israel for granted, and it's a huge mistake. And I think this should be a wake-up call, these developments, that we have to do our part to earn the privilege of having Israel and being part of it. You know, this week's parsha, Darbel ben Yisrael b'Yisrael, God said, look, I'm doing my part. I've given you all these miracles. Now it's your part. Get up.
Yeah, but the majority, I don't know what you mean by underestimating our community. The majority of our community is not into v'Yisrael.
Is not what?
Into v'Yisrael.
Well, I think that put to the test and that they would be and they will be and they are. You know, again, they don't always speak out as forcefully as we would like and as often as we would like, and on the issues that we have a special responsibility to do more education to get people to understand it, and especially young people. We're taking them for granted. And again, a whole slew of new discoveries of here, you know, about our past. And I'm just always amazed at how our community, even the committed people, even those who are, you know, involved religiously, educationally, politically, et cetera, don't know and don't tell their children and don't pass on the message. I mean, to talk to them about these developments, not to scare them, but just say, understand, look what Israel's standing against. And this little country is doing so much. It's helping many other countries. You know, that they just came out with the report on the 15 cases where the IDF intervened and saved 2,300 lives. Hundreds of lives that were actually in danger of people losing lives, and hundreds more, like in Haiti, like in Kenya, and all these other places. And I spoke on a panel that raised the question about how does Israel's policy impact. And I know what the answer they want. They want us to say, you know, Israel embarrasses us, Israel knocks us, defeats the board. And I said, but what about all the encouragement? I mean, Six-Day War in Tempe, and then the day-to-day stuff, Startup Nation. Who's in proud doesn't boast about how many Nobel Prize winners from Israel, et cetera? So we got to put things into context. And that's why I'm saying it's not bad news to tell the truth. It's what you got to know. But you can't just tell bad news. You got to say the things that I started off with, that there are really great things happening, too.
The injection of optimism that you get when you walk into the Holy Land, it's amazing.
It is always, I mean, you walk around in Yerushalayim. I was last night in the Minarot Kotel. The things that they developed over the last 6 months, the new discoveries, things that are not open to the public, but when the people will see it, it's just incredible. And if they had more money, we could uncover more and more and more of our past. And everything that they open opens up another vista, another thing of our past. I mean, you walk away from that and you soar. And you say, look, everything is true. All of our Masorah, all of our heritage, the things we learn about. It's true. Here's the proof. You can see it. So it's true. Come to Israel. Believe me, you'll have a great time.
Malcolm, the Jewish people were at the edge. They were at the edge. The only thing that that was at their side or in front of them was the Red Sea. And yet God found a way to bring salvation, even if it was a miraculous gesture.
But it required a man, Nachshon, to make go into the water, up to his nefesh, up to his head, to make it happen. Because God said, look, you got to show that you're ready to do something. Do you appreciate all the things I'm showing you, all the things I've given you? If you take miracles for granted, they don't happen. God said, I could do it. He could have done it. He didn't have to have Nachshon and Kalib make the step into the water. Why did he make them require that? Because people have to show. They have to show that they're ready for it, that they're prepared to take the risks. Everything else will be taken care of if we do our part.
Well said. The other leg of the conference trip is done already, or it's coming up?
No, it's coming. We have the mission here and elsewhere, and we will talk about it in the coming weeks as we get closer to it.
Meaning, because it's not this journey. It's coming up later
in
February.
People should look also, by the way, at the riots in Egypt. This is very serious and could have a lot of implications. All of them know, and we talked about it a lot, to how important Egypt is in the Middle East to Israel, the biggest Arab country powerful country right now, not very powerful, but still very, very significant. This could be exploited by the Muslim Brotherhood. This could be a move to remove the generals who at least brought some stability. The fighting in Tunisia, the fighting in Syria, the fighting in Iran. I mean, there are really serious waves here, but the Egyptian riots, I think, are of real concern, and we should not dismiss it and say it's an internal matter. It could have a lot of ramifications that would be important. We see that Israel is engaging in exercises, that mobilization that simulated a rocket attack from Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza, and how they could mobilize the troops under those circumstances. It was a successful exercise, but it reminds you that of the considerations Israel has to always take into account.
Unbelievable. All right, thanks for joining us. Enjoy Yerushalayim. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein, live from Israel. He's chairman. He's executive vice chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Fridays here at JM and the AM.